G'day everybody, Aaron Noonan here. Welcome to the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken, a world leader in engineered bearings and mechanical power transmission products and services. Now my guest on the podcast this week is a two-time Bathurst 1000 winner. In fact, he was the enforcer long before there was an enforcer. Alan Grice was in great form when I spoke to him recently. Now, part one of the podcast, we talk about all sorts of stuff. We talk about his early days and how he got into motorsport. We talk about his time as a pastry cook. We talk about how he finally won Bathurst in 1986 on his 15th attempt at the great race. We talk about whether he loved the underdog tag. And speaking of dogs, we talk about his very famous Labrador, Sam Grice, who some of our older listeners might remember from the late 70s, early 80s. Our younger listeners definitely will learn something on this episode. Here we go. Buckle up. Time to start part one of Alan Grice on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken. Well, many people have asked, but we have finally got Alan Grice on the V8 Sleuth podcast. Gricey, welcome. We've got so much to talk about, so much to cover. I think it's hard to know where to start, but I think we should start now. What are you doing with yourself these days? A lot of our fans who don't see you around the racetracks and stuff like that would love to know, what are you up to? What's keeping you busy?
Oh, just the normal stuff, you know, helping old ladies across the road and realigning their walking sticks and just stuff like that.
Oh, it's very kind of you.
Stuff I've done all my life, really.
Really? Are you sure this is not turning over a new leaf and a new thing? This has been going on for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Sunny day on the Gold Coast as we speak, I presume?
Naturally.
Yeah, I figure.
We don't, accept anything other than perfect days up here.
Now we know why you moved there. Now we know.
Exactly.
There's so many topics to talk about. We've got so many questions from our V8 Sleuth fans who listen to the podcast religiously every week. We'll get to them a little bit later.
Sure.
One of the things, and you and I have been privileged over the journey of the last few years to spend a fair bit of time with you. We did some Shannon's Legends TV stuff. We've done some magazine stories and some bits and pieces along the way. But I've never stopped to really ask you, what really got you started in racing? Was it were your family motorheads? Was it just you on your own bat? How did you get into this mad caper of going car racing?
Well, after I left school, so, you know, I'm sort of 18 or something, I went to a race at Warwick Farm with a couple of mates from Maitland, which is, you know, 3 hours away. And I was hooked that day. I said, you know, I'd never had a go-kart or a cross-country bike or anything like that. And what I saw that day, I said on the way home to these blokes, I'm going to do that. And I did.
You did for a very long
time.
Years,
but there you go.
What was the young A. Grice? What, were you good at school? Were you a rat bag? Were you a loner? Were you everybody's mate? What sort of a kid was Alan Grice?
I played most sports. I could play sport. Swimming, springboard diving, cricket, because I was swimming in the summer sports, rugby league, and then I went to change schools, rugby union, and I was very much into sport, and I was good at most of them. When somebody stood over me with a gun, I could pass exams, but I wasn't completely dumb, but I wasn't all that keen on the schoolwork, I've got to say.
Yeah, fair enough. So I guess a bit of that versatility in all those sports and things you're into, that flowed through into your car racing, because you were never afraid to try different types of cars, different categories, different opportunities, different countries.
No, very true.
Kind of a bit
very
of it. I guess that's where it started.
Yeah, and I think, a lot of the success I had was because I could sort a car. And, you know, I had pretty good contracts with Bridgestone and then Yokohama, where they'd pay me a retainer. And they'd put me on a plane and fly me to Mount Fuji or somewhere to test a new innovation in their tyre development, because I used to give them the best feedback. You know, and they'd test you all the time. They'd come in and they'd pull 6 pounds out of your front left or something, and you had to pick that up and come back in and say, "I think that we've got a puncture in the front left. We've got less," you know. Mm. And they look at each other and wink and nod and put 6 pounds in it. And in fact, there were times over the years when with Bridgestone, more particularly, more so than Yokohama, but Peter Brock was also contracted to them. And they'd fly two lots of tyres and two lots of technicians out to, say, Sydney and go to Emeru. And then they'd put a set of tyres on and they'd tell you to go out and do, you know, six hard laps and bring it in hot. Don't let the tyres cool. So you'd do that and they'd put a clipboard in front of you as you sat in the car with your helmet and everything on. And you had to give tyre performance or facets of tyre performance 10 or 9 or 10 or 6 or none out of 10. So the first one would be turn in, you know, and it was turning in very, very good. You didn't have to turn your wheels very, your hands very much on the wheel. You know, you might give it an 8 or a 7 for turn in. But if it built it out of the corner sideways, your power down, you might give it a 3. And they'd give you these boards when you were hot and all the memories were fresh in your head. And while you're doing that, they'd take those tyres off and put another set on and send you out again to do 6 hot laps and bring it in hot. And then you'd give you the clipboard and you know, instead of 7 turn-in, this turn-in might have gone down to 4 or 5. And so it goes. And the technicians would be able to parallel their thoughts on what the tyre should do because of the way they've designed it to the feedback that the driver is giving. And they'd sent two lots of technicians and two mountains of tyres for Brock to test one lot, me to test the other lot. And I found out later that they used to, sending another set of people and tyres out. At the end of the day, they'd say, oh, thank you very much, Mr. Brock, and thank you, Mr. Grice. They'd screw all his comments up and throw them in the tin. But they had to do it because he was contracted to them. That made him feel good. But that's the way it was, you know, and I didn't know at the time and I wouldn't have complained if I did.
Yeah, it's a long list of stuff I wanted to get through with you, and we won't get to it all, but we'll do our very best, Gricey. But as a young bloke, so I remember as a kid they used to, and tell me the story about they used to build you up as the pastry cook that went racing. Did they put a bit of extra sauce on that? Was it one of your jobs? Was it your job totally? How far did they build that up on you?
Well, in those days, you know, you went into the family business. You didn't have a lot of options. You didn't have a lot of choice. But in a way it helped me because, you know, in motor racing, you're always your own sponsor for quite a long time. Mm. And the fact that I was a tradesman as a pastry cook meant I could work at night and get a tradesman's wage. And I could drive a dairy truck for Oak Butter Factory during the day and get a full man's wage. And the weekends I wasn't racing, I used to drive a cab for Ford's cabs in Maitland. So I was getting 2.5 wages a week. And let me tell you, when you're working 2.5 jobs, you haven't got time to have a glass of beer and twist it up against the wall. I was the sponsor.
Was doing all those jobs purely for the purpose of building the money bank up to go and buy a race car?
Purely.
Yeah.
And to pay for the upkeep and the pay for mechanics to help you. In those days, you know, you only paid the mechanics if they were a couple of mates. You just paid them all their expenses and their accommodation and all that sort of stuff. It weren't actually paying them for the work they did. I don't know. It's obviously changed now, but that in those days, you know, you were happy to have a couple of mates to help you.
Mm. Well, it's changed just a little bit now. But what what was your first road car? What was your first race car?
First race car was a MGTC that had already been modified with roll bars and bigger wheels and stuff like that. It was a race car when I bought it. And I won my first race in it and rode it off in the second.
Short race life. Where was that at? Oran Park? Amaru?
Oran Park. Oran Park, I rode it off. And the club race I won was on the club circuit at Warwick Farm.
Yep.
And then I saved up and bought an Elfin Clubman, which was, you know, a copy of a Lotus Super 7. Raced that with some success. Then went to a Formula 2 Elfin monocoque. And those times I was getting a bit of help from Elfin, but only in better purchase price of the car, probably at cost or something like that.
Was the
Gary Cooper was a good guy.
Was the aspiration, Gricey, at the time, I mean, because you did a bit of open wheeler, were you trying to go down the pathway of open wheeler racing, or were you just going, I'll race anything, don't really care, whatever I can get my bum into and whatever's the next deal that I can afford?
Yep, the latter.
Yeah.
It was whatever you could get your bum in. And, you know, I mean, I even raced a Hillman Ip GT for a couple of races.
There's nothing you didn't have a go in.
No, on trucks.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, trucks at Calder.
Gee. Oh, there's probably some stories there. What? So in this time, I've asked a lot of people on this podcast too, along the way, along the journey of a racing career, you do come across people who you just meet at the right time, whether it's someone who saw that you had a bit of talent and went, well, I'll stick some money into that young fella, or I'll give an opportunity or a discount on a car or a deal on some tyres or whatever it is. Who along the way, and I guess there's probably a few people in those early years before people really knew who you were, who are those people who, if it wasn't for them, you might not have got to the next step and the step after that?
Terry Marnie comes straight to mind. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. But he was a young bloke who with SAS steering wheels and seats and other accessories, SAAS, and he needed a figurehead, and he went to, I think it was Brock, and couldn't afford him. And then he went to Moffat and couldn't afford him. And I was next on the list for some reason. I don't think I was from a fame point of view at that point of time, but I was on the next one to approach. And he said, how much? He said that he approached the other two blokes to tell the truth, and that was him to a T, to tell the truth. And he said, what sort of retainer would you want to be the figurehead for our advertising? And I said, well, mate, you're in a better position to quote numbers. How much can you afford? And he said how much it was, and I forget how much it was, honestly. And I said, all right, but the company's growing, isn't it? He said, oh, yeah, it is growing, and it's going to grow more when I get a good figurehead and some more advertising going. So I said, all right, we'll start off at what you can afford, and on the understanding that as the company, the profits improved, that so does the retainer. And he said, right, out and deal. And he was true to his absolute word. I'd get a check every month. And without talking or negotiating, next month it'll be just slightly more. Mm. And the week after that, the month after that, it'll be slightly more. And we got to a stage when I was, as often happens in motor racing, I was between teams or between major sponsorship or something. And I rang, my check still kept coming in. I rang him and said, look, Terry, you know where I'm at. I've lost that sponsor or that ride or that backing. And I can't tell you, sit here and tell you right now exactly when I'll be in a car again. And he said, mate, we've got pretty friendly over the years, haven't we? And I said, oh, yeah, definitely. He said, well, let me tell you something. Mind your own bucket business.
Here, take the money and shut up.
Exactly, yeah. Don't ring me up and tell me this. Just be quiet. I know you'll get another car. I know you'll get another sponsor. I know you'll get back. I know you'll be on the track again. This. Leave it to me.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, Terry. but what a great bloke.
Yeah. You reminded me too that it wasn't, and I was going to ask you about Sam the Labrador. Will, who works here with us at V8 Sleuth, wanted me to remind our listeners, and some of the younger audience probably don't know this, but as a chocolate Labrador owner myself, I know you're a big you're a big dog guy. Your young bloke Benny's got a little dog that he's called Barry, who I see on Instagram, who is being treated like a royal king of late. But didn't Sam the Labrador, late 70s, early 80s, he was at all the racetracks with you. He was in some of those SAS photo shoots, and he was he had his own past, didn't he?
Well, he used to ride what do you call it, a column for the Sunday Telegraph with a drawing of his head with a Craven Mile hat on at the top of the column. and he was allowed into all of the racetracks because, I mean, he was better behaved than the mechanics. If you tell him to sit out, he'd stay there all day. And so a lot of other people started to bring their dogs into the pits. So Cams blew up and said, okay, reinforce the law that already exists with no dogs in the pits. So the promoters got together and got him a press pass that he used to clip onto his collar. So it was Sam Grice, motoring journalist, because he used to write in the Sunday.
He wrote a column. He got cred. He got his credentials. Yeah.
So Cam's just smiled behind their hand and let it be known that there'd be no complaints about the journalists coming in to watch.
Are there a lot of the listeners who were probably following the sport really closely in the late 70s, early 80s will remember that. And if you look back through some of the old magazines, he pops up in lots of places and there's articles. And he was probably the most famous dog in Australian motor racing for a 5 or 6 or 7 year period there. But
no doubt.
What happened to Sam? Did he grow to old age or what happened with him?
Oh, he did get to a good age. It's always a sad thing when dogs around 11 to 13 seems to be bad years for them. But a good big dog's better than most people anyway. That's true.
I'd agree with that. I've never owned a dog till the last few years, but I now get it. As a dog
you
owner.
You now get it.
The SAS connection was a good one there because I came across a photo the other day of you, and I think it was in your Craven Mild era, doing a photo shoot with a SAS steering wheel, and there was Sam lurking in the background there getting in and no doubt helping that photo get into the papers at the time as well. We talked a bit about your early years and what got you in and how you got yourself up and rolling, but probably the one that you get asked about your Bathurst wins a lot, you get asked about the Craven Mile, the NASCAR stuff. We've got plenty of time to talk through some of that. Bathurst debut. Fiat. There's not too many blokes who've been Bathurst 1000 winners, in fact none, who made their debut in the great race in a Fiat. How did that come together? And I know it was with Bill Tuckey, the late motoring journalist, but how did you end up with your first Bathurst run?
It was David Mackay obviously made a good quid out of it, of running, preparing and managing and running the Fiat 124 Sport Coupe, give it its full name.
Sounds exotic.
Scuderi Veloci ran it for Fiat. And David Mackay had seen me in Formula 2 Hill for Mono and thought I could drive a bit. And Bill Tuckey would give it a lot of publicity. I think he was the editor of one of the magazines at that stage of the game and well-known in motor trade. And so that's how the two of us came together, because Bill Tuckey had given it some PR and I might have given it a bit of pace.
1968.
Yeah, there you go.
Is that your first time at Bathurst? Had you been there before in anything else or as a spectator?
Mate, I hadn't even been there for a milkshake before.
What a way to turn up in a Fiat 124 Sport. Wow.
Yeah. driven on the road from Sydney.
Exactly, the days of the race cars driving to the race and from the race, something.
Yeah, and very often running an engine in on the way.
different times. It took a few years, though, for you to get back there, but the next time you were a reserve in the Tirana, you were in 72, you were lined up ready to, in those days, we should explain to the listeners that it's not like it is now where you enter, you turn up, you qualify, you race. In those days, there were more entries than they could fit onto the track. They'd say, righto, this many cars from these classes are in. Yep. And then in each class, there'd be a couple of reserves. So if anybody fell out, blew up an engine or got sick or whatever, you're first one in the queue ready to go in. But you still went and practiced and you got time on the track and you put together a time. But I think you were like, you qualified really well, but you were a reserve and you were waiting on the race morning there in the dummy grid for a few cars to fall out and it didn't quite work your way and you missed out.
That's exactly right. And even the detail is finer, is even sadder, in that I think the average, we looked at it, the average year they'd start approximately 15 reserves, because people didn't take a truckload of spares or spare cars or spare engines. You just took a car to Bathurst. And if the gearbox broke and you couldn't get a gearbox from the local dealer, it's all over over. So you're out, and there'd be people trying to rebuild engines all overnight and getting parts up from Sydney, and they wouldn't make it. So there's another car out. So there's another reserve step forward. I think they used to start 60-odd cars, and they'd take 15 or more reserves. And as I recall, we were probably 12th or 13th reserve, but we went there thinking that the average that started was number 15 reserve, so averages, we should get a start. And I think I qualified the car at the back end of the top 10 out of the 60-odd cars, and we were reserve 13th, and they started reserve 12th, and we were left at the dummy, the gate into the dummy grid. With sitting in the car with my helmet and my hat and my gloves on.
With a car that was fast enough to run in the top 10.
Yeah.
Just couldn't correct. Get on the track.
Get it on the track.
Not long ago, Gricey, we did a podcast about Holden drivers at Bathurst. And I find it really interesting because you drove Holdens for so many years, and I think the fans, and I know I do, identify you as a Holden driver because you just drove Taranas and Commodores for so many years. But it wasn't – it was just the best – and only opportunity that you had for equipment. So you don't deem yourself a, you know, when they do the list of Holden racing legends, you probably don't deem yourself that because you don't deem yourself a Holden guy. You just deemed yourself Alan Grice, who will drive the best thing he can get his hands on. Would you agree with that? Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. That's 100% right. You know, I drove factory-supported Fords there. I drove factory BMWs there. But I only once drove a factory Holden. That was with Wynn Percy in 90.
Yeah. So for years you'd been the Craven Mild, Recar, Roadways, all that iteration, privateer guy, still in the Holden products, and but not the
STP.
All of those, but not the factory guy. So I think people with race drivers, particularly Australia, there's a lot of drivers that you go, yep, we'd identify him as a Holden driver, just the way the fans look at it, or Ford, you know, Dick Johnson's Ford, Peter Brock's Holden, Craig Lowndes, you could probably say is a bit of both because he's been on both sides of the fence. But, I just found it's a really interesting dynamic there where you get put in the red pile, but you probably don't deem yourself a red pile guy. It's just the way it worked out.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Race cars was the thing. They had a number on them, so they must have been good.
Yeah. Hey, you what was with it with the number six? That became your thing there for a long time. That was your identifiable number, and you'd a lot of drivers
asked that before, and I don't know.
Really?
Yeah, it wasn't the star I was born under or anything like that.
There's no good story. It's just a random number.
I'm afraid not. Oh. I wish there were. My mech went up. Ask me next year.
we'll conjure up some good story that we can wheel out next year. But how did that – I remember the Craven Mild, of course, different time now. Cigarette advertising is long gone, but wasn't it
By the way, isn't it a nonsense when you see a red and white car or a white and gold car, a photograph of it, in a story that they're doing about, you know, some race in bloody 1980, and they have to blank out the word Craven Mild or the word Marlborough. How ludicrous, you know, just a photograph of a car with a cigarette logo on it, is that going to make some kid rush out and buy a packet of cigarettes? Well, where's the bloody common sense about with that?
I think you'll get a lot of agreements from our listeners, mate, particularly off the basis of that Shannon's Legend series we did on Channel 7, where Channel 7 are very, very much careful with the Cigarette Act, and we had to blur the vision of Craven Mild and Marlborough and
absolute nonsense.
Camel filters and all that stuff over the years. But
it's history. It's part of history.
I agree totally. You know? I'm probably good proof. I'm 39. I've never been a smoker. I sat up and watched, and I grew up watching Australian motor racing, Marlborough, Peter Stuyvesant, Craven, Peter Jackson, B&H, all of them. I've never smoked, and I've never had an inclination to. So there you go. So,
Well, I've smoked and had plenty of inclination to, but I've given them up as well.
good man. How did that Craven Mile thing start? Because that really sort of helped take you to the next level with your touring cars.
Yeah, I happen to know that. there was a guy called Paul Older, Dr. Paul Older, I think it was, and he lived next door to a man who shall remain nameless, who was a very senior executive at WD&HO Wills, and lived next door to him, and they were mates, and he was started in the motor racing, and he said to his next door neighbour, I'm buying this 2002 race car, should get some sponsorship on it. And they said, yeah, okay. So they put Craven Mile sponsorship on it. And it was a 2002 BMW, was, you know, racing against V8s and all that sort of stuff. So its first race was at Amaru, and they sent out their motorsport manager, who was a bloke by the name of Phil May, to watch Paul Older go around in the Craven Mile 2002. And in the same on the same day, the same weekend, I was running a, I think it was XU1, and John Goss tipped me over the back of the circuit and rolled over and brought it back into the pitch, and there were half a dozen people out of the crowd surrounded, descended on with my two mates who were mechanics, wailing away with hammers. And the last thing we did before we went out for the final was somebody ripped their belt off to tie the driver's side door to the pillar because the locking mechanism was buggered. So we got the belt on the driver's side door, and I drove out, took up position on the grid, and won the final and beat Goss. And the Phil May went back and reporting back for the racing at the weekend. And they said, how did Paul Older go? And he said, never mind, buddy, Paul Older. He started second last and finished last. This Grice bloke's the one. He's the one that he had the crowd helping repair his car. He had the crowd going berserk. We've got to get on to him. So they let it be known that I should approach them, which I did. And it took 5 minutes. I got some sponsorship.
Best deal ever. 5 minutes. That's for a deal that ran for probably, what, 5, 6, 7 years?
Oh, well, more.
Yeah.
More. And then carried over to JPS because they owned that brand too.
Yeah, same company, different brand, different colours.
Yeah.
So was it at that point? That's how it happened. Was it at that point, Gricey, that you considered yourself a full-time professional racing driver? Did it allow you to be in that mould where that's all you did, that you could give away all the other jobs and just go car racing?
Not straight away. Straight away, it... I still used to work in the family business at night, which would pay my bills, you know, so I could pay my rent and eat. Mm. And the sponsorship used to run the car and one mechanic.
Yep.
And then two mechanics, and, you know, so it went on. And then you get, you know, it breeds. It becomes a tumbleweed because, you know, tyre companies want to be on cars that win. They're competitive. They're on the television screen. So you start to get free tyres, and you start to get paid to use tyres, and you get paid to test tyres, and you get better at that, so you're worth more money, all that sort of stuff. But the ancillary stuff you've got to be pretty smart and put it together.
We'll get back to the podcast in just a moment, but I wanted to quickly tell you about our good friends at Timken, a world leader in engineered bearings and mechanical power transmission products and services. Now, you might know their name and you might recognise their logo, but did you know that Timken bearings are used in the centrepiece of one of the most stunning stadiums in the world of sport? The $2 billion, yes, billion-dollar Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta features a retractable roof that is a work of incredible engineering. It features 8 triangular roof panels, or pedals as the designers call them, that slide open and close in the same way that a camera shutter does. Each pedal weighs almost 500 metric tons, and when the roof is closed, each pedal cantilevers over 60 metres from the outer edge of the stadium. Now, despite the weight, the size and the complexity of the design, the roof can be closed in just over 7 minutes and opened in just over 8, with Timken's tapered roller bearings used to ensure each pedal moves smoothly. The stadium's home to the Atlanta Falcons NFL team and the Atlanta United Major League Soccer team, And in 2019, it hosted the crown jewel of American football, the Super Bowl. We'll bring you more cool facts about Timken in each episode of the V8 Sleuth podcast through the course of the year. Now, it's back to the podcast.
Did you always want to run it as your own program? Sometimes, I think a lot of guys who, that was just the era of the sport that happened, but
yeah.
Did it get to the point where you go, no, I like doing it this way because I'm in control, and if I know what's going on with all the elements of my business, and yeah, I've got to find the money and I've got to get the blokes to work on the car and I've got to go and hammer on that door to find some more deals and do all the bits and pieces that an owner driver's got to do. Did you get to the point where you thought, I've got to either step up or step down here, and but I'll go my own way and keep doing it my way? Is that the way that you wanted to approach it?
I think that you very often don't create your own destiny. There's a lot of the way cards fall, like the fact that the sponsorship manager went to Amaru on that day to watch Paul Older, and he opened the door for me to come in and present a prop. Mm. And, you know, things happen that you don't plan for, and you've got to be ready to go with them, I think. You've got to be sort of pretty light on your feet. You've got to be a 5'8" rather than a forward.
Yeah. It's a good way to apply a football piece of terminology to motor racing, for sure. What's the best deal you ever did? Don't give me the numbers or anything, but what was the best deal that you walked away from going, yep, that was a good one? Walking out of a boardroom one day, that was one that was well worth us coming to play today.
I think it was in the first time that WDHO Wills agreed to the sponsorship that we had arrived at jointly, you know, for Craven Mile Days, because that was very enduring. It went on and on, and they were good people. You know, they'd often use you. That they'd had every couple of Fridays, they'd have 5 o'clock drinks. And they'd have, you know, other people that they'd invite along there, and they'd bring their driver along, their Craven Mile driver along, and they used to use you as much as they could, and that's what it's about. You know, if you think motor racing is anything more than advertising and promotion, you're in the wrong sport.
Mm.
And you've got to go along with that, and you've got to be good at it too, I guess.
Oh, you got to survive. That's the thing.
Yeah, well, yeah. Not just being good under brakes.
Yeah, that's part of it. You got to do that too, but you got to you got to get the money to buy the brakes, and you got to get the money to get the guys
Absolutely.
To fix the brakes and work on the brakes and all of the above. There's so much fondness that fans look back on the cars of that era, the L34 Taranas, the A9X Taranas, the hardtop Falcons, those classic Aussie muscle car battles, and the guys who were doing the driving, you and Moffat and Brock and Dick and Bobby Morris and.
Yep.
So many of those guys. In reality, though, when it's the car that is the latest and greatest at the time, have you looked at some of those cars in more modern years and gone, oh, God, how did we do that? How did we drive these things? Because everything moves along and we always get a bit locked back in that whole rose-coloured glass thing. What were those things like to drive in that period at the time, and have you driven one in the more modern years?
Yeah, I did some years ago now. But for some reason, the sponsors at was probably the ARDC at Bathurst. I'm going back some years. They wanted to run some of the original sort of L34 type cars, and they wanted some people who'd raced them with some success to drive them around to show the crowd, if you like. Now, they were bloody awful. I forget which L34 it was, but Christ, how did you drive this? And the thing is, too, that you know, you'd be running so much caster and so much camber that until you got that were going fast enough to get the car up on its toes, is the expression, they were so bloody heavy. You know, at road speed, they were dreadful to steer. They were so heavy. You'd get an ache in the shoulder. But once you got through that and you went quick enough to get them up on and away from their cast and away from their camber, they were quite reasonable to drive. So to drive them anything but flat out, they were horrible.
And it's staggering to think that at the time it was just a device that now some years they're worth, you know, a couple of $100,000, where at the time you probably couldn't give one away when you're trying to get the next car and go along. Mate, Bathurst eluded you for so many years. 15 starts before you got the win with Graham Bailey in 86 in the Chickadee car. Was it a case in all those close but not quite theirs, the 70s, the Taranas, the early 80s in the Commodores, was it a case where you just didn't quite have enough manpower, money, luck, made some mistakes, didn't do things right? What do you put your finger on why some of those things didn't quite come through? When on paper they looked all right.
Well, there were two reasons. One is that the advantage the factory teams had in those days was much more than the factory teams have today. That's because there's a lot more sponsorship, a lot more money, and the private teams can hire engineers as good or better than the factory teams. But that wasn't the case. In those days, there was an enormous advantage in that the factory teams had. I remember Harry Firth walking up to me in the pits at Warwick Farm one weekend and said, and this was in the days of series production, and he walked up and he said, here you are, Cock, here's the latest camshaft. This is on Saturday morning. Like, he'd had that, he'd done the grinds on the cam and been running it in on dynos and changing valve timing and changing exhaust lengths and diameters to suit it. So he got the most out of the new camshaft, which was series production, which was supposed to be, you know, the new standard series production camshaft. And he's given it to you on Saturday morning at Warwick Farm, and he's been, you know, developing and testing it for 3 months. I mean, that's some bloody advantage.
Just a little bit.
And, you know, when you'd get some front guards that arrived that Parry's been using for 2 years, and they were a thinner pressing. They'd stamp them in the fact they'd wait for a weekend and they'd go in and stamp front guards for an XU1 or whatever it was over the weekend, and they'd get, you know, 12 or 15 sets of guards. Because when the tin is so thin, they're hard to repair, so they just throw them away. If they get a dent, they will whack another one on. Mm. You know, all that sort of stuff. Well, the teams these days, they make their own bloody guards. So, you know, that there's no advantage in getting the thin pressings from the factory over a long weekend.
Yeah, we're in a very different era. The concept of, or the term,
absolutely,
factory team is pretty much, you know, we're talking supercars here, obviously, but it's dead. Like, you don't have, you know, there might be a badge and a sticker and some money being spent and some marketing budget, but there's technical connectivity is not there. So, as you said, the advantage still comes from cubic dollars, but it doesn't so much come because there's a door open to a big factory somewhere, either in Campbellfield or down in Fisherman's Bend. So
the good private teams with the good finances, the good backing, might have better race engineers than the so-called factory team.
Mm, yeah, exactly. I get the feeling too, Gricey, that you really grabbed the underdog privateer. I think the late, great Mike Raymond, who did so much for you and so many people, called you the Prince of the Privateers, but... You seem to, and I know it would have grinded your gears that you were constantly up against dealer team and Firth and Brock and Bond and those blokes who had a bit of an advantage over you all the time in those areas, but I reckon you loved being the underdog, to take it up to the establishment. You did it for years. Did you relish that? Did you love to put almost the black hat on and be that guy and be the alternative viewpoint and be the other guy on the other side of the argument, whether it's on or off the track? Or I get the feeling always relished that. You've always loved it.
I'll answer that in two ways. One is that when you know what advantage that the factory team has, you always would like to be included in the factory team. You'd like to be asked, would you like to join? However, I'm sure that, as you are suggesting, I appreciated where I was coming from, and I appreciated more the victories when they came my way, because it was more me that did it. It wasn't Harry did this and Harry developed that, therefore I did this. Oh, we got all these mechanics, they did that, and Dunlop did this and all that sort of stuff. So it does, you do claim more ownership of the wins of the victories.
Mm.
And also, you know, when you start getting into developing tyres that suit your package and you, that's very satisfying too. I developed this tyre and I just won on this tyre, and that's, you know, you get a great deal of satisfaction out of that sort of stuff.
So I guess, therefore, that those things all come together and you could cook them together, and that's Bathurst 1986. You drove most of the laps. Les Small, who you worked with for many years, prepped that car. Graham Bailey obviously was his car, and he provided the sponsorship and the backing to do it. You'd gone and done a bit of stuff in Europe earlier in the year. Well, you did a lot of stuff in Europe earlier that year. But I guess then that's the ultimate expression of what we've just discussed, where you didn't just get co-opted into a, you know, you didn't turn up with your helmet bag and sign up for the best team. And it's kind of like a football player who plays 10 years with a club that struggles, gets to the free agency window now, and then goes and signs for a contender and wins a flag the next year. It's kind of like that, where you went, no, I've done the graft, I'm doing it our way, and then you get the reward. That was the ultimate that day, where that formula, that strategy came together to give you the great result.
Yeah, that's very true, very true. And, you know, everything was just right. The wind was coming from the right direction, the sun was out, the tyres were good, the brakes were bulletproof. It was just it was a day that was meant to be.
Mm.
A lot of years of hard work went into it.
Yeah, it wasn't a one-day wonder. It was 15 tries to get there.
Yeah.
Tell me too, mate, because Graham Bailey was the sponsor. Now, the interesting part of that was the end of a piece of Bathurst history, because I think from memory he did the one stint. It was, what, 20-something, 30 laps, something like that. You did 130 or thereabouts or something like that. I don't have the numbers in front of me. And the rule came in after that, where each driver had to do a minimum amount. So here's the question. If that rule had been in place and Graham had to do two stints, not one, would you reckon you still would have won?
Would have been close.
I guess it's a big thing for him too, because we've seen it over the years that the guy who pays the bills, he's got his company on the car, his name's on the window. He's quite within his right to say, no, I'm paying the bills. I want to do my fair share. I want to drive the lion's share or whatever it is.
Sure.
Was that a case where he said, our best chance to win this race is letting you do most of the running?
Absolutely. And, you know, when we were building a car to go to Europe, he was involved because he was getting a car built for Australia. And he said, how are you going to do it over there? Who's going to drive with you? And I said, I don't know. I haven't got to that. He said, all my bloody life I've dreamt about going to Monza and places like that. He said, how much would it cost me? And that's where it started. All my life I've wanted to drive in Monza.
And he did.
He did. And he was quick enough. He was not a number one driver, but he was quick enough, and he was tidy. You know, he didn't throw it off the road. I'd be more likely to throw it off the road. He went in a few sand traps, but that happened. I've been in them myself.
Yeah. Means you're not trying hard enough if you don't find a few of them along the way. How satisfying was that win in 86? I think the fans out there have got a deep love for that win, because it was at a time when the turbo cars, the Volvos, the Nissans, Group A were starting to really rise, and the Commodore was under threat by all these invaders. Yet at that place in that race, if you're in a Commodore, you still had a pretty big sniff to be able to win it.
You're talking about 90?
Oh, 86, probably more so beforehand. But 90certainly was the case.
No, most certainly was the case, because those turbos, you know, we knew they had two weaknesses. One was a pace car, because they'd overheat behind a pace car, because they relied so much on a rush of air through the radiator. It was just the way they were built and set up. You know, you could you could change the radiator and change the water pumps and make them so that they drive for 20 Ks for a fortnight. But to race them, that's what they used to do. They used to overheat the turbos behind pace cars. And similarly, they didn't like a long time in second gear going up mountain straight, a longer time in third gear going up mountain straight, and a longer time in fourth gear going up mountain straight. And they'd just sit there wide open, just building heat. So we figured if we could, because we knew they turn the go, they do a sprint and then they turn the turbos back. We knew if we could run hard enough that they would there's every chance they'd overheat, and they did one at a time, poof. So you know it was as much a blow 'em up win as it was just a straight out pace win.
Mm. And the great irony too that. HRT as it had become, Wyn Percy was running it on behalf of Tom Walkinshaw, but Tom wasn't a fan of Grice. He didn't want you in the car. No. He had other ideas on who he wanted to drive, but Wyn stood strong and said, no, I want Gricey. And I think Tom's words were, on your head, so be it. And that's so correct. Be it. It worked.
It did, yeah. No, that's exactly true. Wyn actually said to him, Tom, you hired me to manage the team. Now let me manage the team.
There you go.
So be it on your so be it.
And wasn't it that you and Walkinshaw had some run-ins back when you were racing in Europe? There was a particular round late in the year, that European year that you did, that I think that's where you flicked the switch on Tom not being a fan of you. Wasn't it that you – was there a bit of pressure on you to do something that you didn't want to do from my memory? What was that? Tell our listeners.
I forget his name now, but his team manager, Blake, chief mechanic, came up to me in the pits at Estoril, I think. It was one of those, I think it was Estoril, and said that if I, what were we talking, the Volvos? No, I think
they
it was BMWs.
They were in the Rovers at that stage.
Yeah, but I think it was they were being challenged by the BMWs.
For the championship,
Yes, for the championship, for the European Touring Car Championship. And he came up and suggested that if I was to have one of the two of them off, that I'd have a couple of, business class tickets back to Australia to use whenever I wanted. And I said, will you go back and tell Tom that if that's the way he wants to go motor racing, don't ever fucking talk to me about it again. Also, I'll smack you in the nose and I'll smack him in the nose too. And he didn't lie to me after that.
Oh, wow. And how
actually do that? You know, I mean, for Christ's sake, the European Touring Car Championship, it's the most principled, you reckon, touring car championship in the world. And they want to – Jesus.
What were some of the rule stretching that was going on, some of the stuff that you turned up there and saw and thought, hang on a minute, there's a few players playing not with a straight bat here.
Yeah. Well, even when they came out for Bathurst, you couldn't move you couldn't put a front wheel and tyre on – you couldn't use one wheel and tyre on the first – four or five Sierras. They were all different. Mm. Different offsets, different just bullshit.
I do love how some of the fans these days get riled up about how the parity and the technical discussions relating to supercars, we should go back to Group A because it was so much better. And you go, clearly you weren't around in that era to know some of the stuff that was going on in the bun fights and the technical
and
dramas.
The track, they they cut a bloody turret down the middle with a bloody great chainsaw and put about 6 or 8 inches in the middle of it. And the track would be 6 inches wider front and rear. Figure that out.
That's hard.
Everybody's measuring the guard, saying, oh, they're widening the guards to get more track. They've widened the fucking body. they've cut a hole through the turret.
Alan Grice in really good form on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken. That's part one done. Don't fret, there's still part two, and there's plenty of great topics to cover. We talk about NASCAR racing and crashing NASCARs as well. We talk about racing at the Le Mans 24 Hour with Gricey.
his time in Queensland politics, in ute racing, and we also throw at him the National Motor Racing Museum Couch Racer questions and the Motor Focus Top 10 Shootout. Quick one too. If you're struggling for a gift idea for Christmas, grab a V8 Sleuth gift card. Jump on our website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au, grab a gift card for someone special for Christmas and make it their problem. What they buy, whether it's a book, a print, a DVD, a poster, a magazine, jump on our online store now and, of course, you'll get that sent straight out to you. You don't need to worry about waiting for presents to arrive through Australia Post. Jump on the website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. Subscribe to our newsletter through our regular website, v8sleuth.com.au. Follow us on socials, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We're always up to something there. In the meantime, though, that's episode part one of Alan Grice, done on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken. Click along and make sure you listen to part two.